Ogden has a small town feeling with big city amenities. Located 40 miles north of Salt Lake City, it is one of Utah's best kept secrets. It doesn't matter what part of Ogden one lives in, the residents, one and all, are gifted with a magnificent view of the beautiful Wasatch Mountains. This crime happened just 8 miles from where I live now, and is truly one that Utah has never forgotten. April 22, 1974 is remembered as one of the darkest days in Utah's history. That evening, the Ogden City Police Department were called to the hi-fi shop following reports of a disturbance. Police officers arrived expecting a robbery. What they discovered was much, much worse. For local music lovers, the hi-fi shop was a favorite spot in the 70s. Located on Washington Boulevard, it was known for selling top-notch audio equipment, stereos, and record players. High school kids and adults alike frequented the shop, drawn in by the latest in sound technology. On April 22, 1974, 20-year-old Stanley Walker, who was filling in for a coworker that night, was an easygoing young man with many friends, and 18-year-old Sherry Michelle Ainsley, who went by Michelle, was working at the hi-fi shop. She had only been employed there for a week as a bookkeeper and a cashier. Michelle, with her porcelain features, was described as warm and fun. This was an exciting time for her, as she was due to be married in August of that year. The shop closed at 6 p.m. on Mondays, so Michelle and Stanley were cleaning up, counting receipts, and putting equipment away, when 21-year-old Dale Pierre Selby and 19-year-old William Andrews, accompanied by two other men, entered the hi-fi store. Michelle and Stanley let Selby and his accomplices know that the store was now closed, but Selby didn't leave. Michelle watched as he produced a firearm and pointed it at her head. He then ordered Andrews to tie the pair up and throw them into the basement. Once in the basement, Michelle and Stanley heard the four men rummaging around upstairs, ripping equipment from the shelves and stuffing it into an awaiting van. The pair huddled together and prayed for their safety, while Selby made his way down to the basement. Just as Selby's attention had been turned to Michelle and Stanley, he heard the front door chime. Fearing they had been interrupted by the police or a passerby, Selby and Andrews rushed to the front door. 16-year-old Byron Courtney Nesbitt, who goes by Courtney, came to the shop looking for Stanley, who had told him he could park in the store parking lot earlier in the day, while he ran errands. Once Courtney entered the store, he heard a voice say, "Take another step and I'll shoot you." Courtney threw his hands up, and before he knew it, he was tumbling down the stairs, being kicked and punched in the stomach. Once he landed on the shag carpet in the basement, where he saw Michelle and Stanley, he too was tied up. The three remained laying on the ground while one man held a gun on them and the others continued to loot equipment upstairs. Then they were interrupted again. This time, 43-year-old Orrin Walker, Stanley's father, walked through the front door. According to Gary Kinder and victim, The Other Side of Murder, Orrin was concerned that Stanley may have been having car trouble as he had just purchased a utility Jeep. Armed with jumper cables, Orrin drove to the hi-fi store to see if Stanley needed any help. After entering the store, he too was tied up and forced into the basement. Selby and Andrew stayed with their hostages while their accomplices raided the store. Michelle, Stanley, Courtney, and Oren were beaten, kicked, and punched. Selby especially seemed to get a kick out of hurting them and became excited whenever they showed fear. Sometime later, the final victim, Carol Peterson Nesbitt, arrived at the hi-fi store looking for her son, 16-year-old Courtney. It was unlike him to come home late, and Carol sensed something was wrong. As she pushed the handle to the front door, Carol gazed into the basement and into the barrel of a gun. She was waved into the basement with the others, where she too was tied up and made to lay down right next to her son, Courtney. While down in the basement, Selby pulled out a bottle, telling the hostages it was a concoction of a German drug and vodka to help them sleep for a couple of hours. Instead, it was Drano, a chemical cleaner composed of sodium hydroxide, which is corrosive and a known irritant. If it comes into contact with tissue, it can burn and cause severe damage. With the gun to their heads, Selby forced the group to drink the Drano, lifting them up and pouring it directly into their mouths, causing immeasurable pain and suffering. Michelle screamed in pain as it slipped down her throat. Most of the hostages were covered in blisters and welts from where the chemicals had burned their skin. Moaning, retching, and coughing filled the air as the hostages desperately attempted to spit the Drano out. Selby tried to duct tape their mouths shut to prevent this, but due to the corrosive nature of sodium hydroxide and other ingredients, the tape didn't stick. Oren Walker, Stanley's father, avoided swallowing the Drano by discreetly allowing the drain cleaner to spill from his mouth and thrashed around on the floor as if he had swallowed it. Andrews, Selby's accomplice in the basement, recalled later how Selby told him that he had come up with the idea of giving the hostages Drano from watching the movie Magnum Force, where a person was forced to drink drain cleaner, causing their death. At one point, Selby and Andrews grabbed a ballpoint pen and forced it into Oren's ear. According to Oren, Selby then proceeded to stomp on the pen, forcing it into his ear canal, which perforated his eardrum and pierced through his throat. Blood pooled from Oren's wounds. Seeing that the hostages weren't dying quickly enough, Selby walked over to Carol Nesbitt and knelt down next to her, with gun in hand. Courtney heard a blast and the sound of the bullet when it hit his mother's head. Her blood spurted out and spattered onto the carpet just inches away from him. Selby walked over Carol's body and stood over Courtney. He bent down, put the muzzle of the gun to the back of his head, and pulled the trigger. He then approached Oren Walker next. Standing with his feet at his head, Selby pulled the trigger. The bullet came within inches of Oren's head, but it hit the carpet and ricocheted into a wall. Selby then turned his attention to Michelle. She begged for her life, pleading with Selby to let her live as she was too young to die. Oren Walker would later testify that Selby seemed to enjoy torturing Michelle and the other hostages. Selby made Michelle go to another room in the basement where he sexually assaulted her. 10 to 15 minutes later, Michelle walked back into the room with the rest of the hostages. This time, she was nude. She again pleaded and begged for her life, but Selby couldn't leave any witnesses, so he cocked his gun, placed it on the back of her head, and fired one shot. He then stepped over Michelle's body and bent low behind Stanley and fired a bullet into the back of his head. Once more, Selby walked over to Oren Walker and aimed the gun at his head and shot. This time, he didn't miss. Thinking they were all dead, Selby and Andrews took one last look at their five hostages and noticed Oren Walker's chest slowly moving up and down. He was still breathing. Selby wrapped a piece of wire around Oren's throat, asphyxiating him, but he was still alive. Selby and Andrews rallied their men, collected the final pieces of equipment, and hit the road. Those who served as getaway drivers knew something horrific had occurred, but were too terrified to ask. The group made away with around $24,000 worth of stereo equipment, which is about $159,000 today, and five victims whose lives would be forever changed. At around 10:30, a disturbance call came in for 2323 Washington Boulevard. When the police arrived, a boy told officers they were inside. When the officers reached the basement, they immediately saw Carol Nesbitt, eyes open, staring up at the ceiling, with red burns around her mouth. Then they saw Stanley. He had a large hole in the back of his head. When the ambulance arrived, Courtney Nesbitt and Oren Walker were immediately transferred to the hospital. Courtney had been shot and forced to drink Drano several times. Courtney's chances of survival were slim. Doctors expected him to die in the early morning, but he defied the odds and survived. For 266 days, Courtney remained in the hospital. On day 267, Courtney was discharged. He left the hospital a different person, but he was alive and at just 16 years old, suffered permanent brain damage. Oren Walker, too, survived, but not without disfigurement and injury. As he had allowed the Drano to slip down his face, his mouth and chin were severely burned, leaving him with a lifetime of facial disfigurement. He also suffered permanent hearing loss after the ballpoint pen was forced into his ear and stomped through his throat. The bullet wound to his head proved to be superficial. Technicians spent 18 hours processing the scene at the hi-fi shop, collecting evidence and taking pictures. The Ogden City Police Department received several tips in the days after the murders, one of which led them to the nearby Hill Air Force Base, where Selby and Andrews were stationed. An associate of Andrews at the barracks told the Ogden City Police Department that Andrews had been planning the spree for months. Andrews had been dead set on burglarizing the hi-fi store and threatened to kill anyone who stood in his way. Hours after investigators learned of this threat, two boys dumpster diving outside the Air Force base came across the IDs and wallets belonging to the hi-fi murder victims. This gave investigators enough cause to execute a full search. Using these tips, Officer George Throckmorton and a handful of detectives were sent to the Air Force base. Selby was no stranger to the investigators, as he was a suspect in another murder. The team received a search warrant for Selby's barracks. Throckmorton told ABC4, "As I went over to lift up the carpet, between the carpet and the padding, there was a folded piece of paper, and as I opened the paper, it was a lease agreement of a storage unit that was about a block from the hi-fi shop, and Selby had signed it." The Ogden City Police Department went to the storage unit, and inside, they found items stolen from the shop. Fingerprints from Selby and Andrews were found on the equipment. One of their accomplices, Keith Leon Roberts, was arrested. Roberts served as one of the getaway drivers. According to reports, the Ogden City Police Department was unable to secure enough evidence to convict the other men who have remained nameless to this day. Keith Leon Roberts was convicted of 2 counts of aggravated robbery and was given 2 concurrent 5-year-to-life sentences and was paroled in 1987. He committed suicide in August 1992 at the age of 38. Andrews and Selby joked with each other and played poker while waiting for the jury to reach their verdict. They were both found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder and 2 counts of aggravated robbery and received the death penalty. At his trial, Andrews admitted to forcing the hostages to drink Drano. The trial and sentencing came with great controversy in Ogden. Many cited racial bias and systemic racism in how the case was handled and the sentencing outcome. Selby and Andrews were black while their victims were white, but the court upheld the sentences. In 1977, Selby took his case to the Supreme Court, where the death penalty was upheld. While in prison, Selby kept a journal, watched soap operas, and tried to come up with ways to start an empire while behind bars. In the end, Selby accepted responsibility for his crime, saying, "They're not executing an innocent man." As his execution approached, Selby turned to scripture reading, meditation, and deep breathing to calm his anxiety. On August 28, 1987, a bar in Ogden held a Selby going away party while others attended a vigil outside the prison. He declined a last meal and spent his final day fasting, praying, singing hymns, and reading the Bible. His last words were, "Thank you. I'm just going to say my prayers." That evening, 34-year-old Selby made his final walk on death row, where he was led to the chamber and died without incident by lethal injection. This was the first execution in Utah since Gary Gilmore, who died by firing squad in 1977. Andrews enjoyed a last meal of a banana split. After arriving at the execution chamber, he wanted to know if he would see his family that was there to witness his death. The warden pointed to them, and after that, Andrews joked about redecorating the chamber and talked about movies he had seen. One of the wardens said to Andrews, "This has been a long haul for you, hasn't it?" Andrews replied, "Yes, I'm actually very tired. In other words, I'm more or less settled and fairly well ready to face the ultimate that is apparently before me." He flashed a smile to his family and friends, then mouthed the words, "I love you," and blew a kiss to his sister. He also added, "Thank those who tried to keep me alive. I hope they continue to fight for equal justice after I'm gone. Tell my family goodbye and that I love them." Andrews was executed by lethal injection on July 30, 1992. Some believed Andrews should not have received the death penalty due to the claims of racial bias during the trial. Courtney Nesbitt, who was 16 at the time of the attack, had just completed his first solo flight 4 months before his tragedy. He was obsessed with flying and had just completed a lesson the very day of the crime. He was an Eagle Scout and loved science, once constructing a telescope, which won a blue ribbon at a science fair. Courtney missed many months of school during his recuperation and rehabilitation. Despite this, he was able to catch up and graduate on time with his class. Courtney continued to make improvements in his life. He attended school, was employed at Hill Air Force Base as a computer technician, and in 1985, he got married. He eventually moved to Seattle and lived there for 15 years and made many friends. In 2002, at the age of 44, Courtney died of an undisclosed illness. Although he continued to experience chronic pain and health issues stemming from the attack on him in 1974, he accomplished more in his life than anyone could have ever imagined. Orrin Walker, who suffered permanent disfigurement and disability, died of cancer on February 13, 2000, at the age of 69. For further reading on this case, I suggest the book Victim, The Other Side of Murder by Gary Kinder. It goes into detail on the lives of the victims before and after the crime.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.